Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. School districts await a statewide book ban list as Utah plans to retroactively enforce a new law. Salt Lake City School District resumes a plan to train all students on what restrooms they can use. Also, will and should the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints ever seal same-sex couples in temples? Tune in to hear what church members think. Joining me are Salt Lake Tribune education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. Carmen, thanks for joining us.
Of course.
The other education reporter with Salt Lake Tribune, Michael Lee, is on with us. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we have religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Thanks, Tamara. We also have, Tamara.
So sorry.
It's that
slow
muting
on the
thing.
Mute button.
That's right.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good to have you with us. Yeah. I have the advantage of visual. I was seeing Tamara was desperately trying to unmute herself. And news columnist Robert Gerke is with us. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start with Carmen Nesbitt. School districts await a statewide book ban list. So this, Carmen, has to do with a law that was passed. There was a law in 2022, then a law this last session. Tell us a bit about these laws.
Yeah, that's correct. And I just want to note for the record that it's 2024 and we're talking about book bans, which just blows my mind. But this new law that was passed this legislative session basically builds upon the 2022 law, which requires districts to remove, you know, quote unquote, sensitive materials. But this new law creates a process for a book's complete statewide removal from school shelves if it meets certain criteria. And that criteria is if three school districts or two school districts and five charter schools ban the same book for being objectively sensitive, then it kind of like leads to an automatic removal from all public schools. And this law, interestingly, applies retroactively to books that have been banned prior to July 1st of this year, which is when the new law takes effect. But applying it retroactively is not as straightforward as, I don't know, maybe lawmakers were thinking, because there's that new criteria of objectively sensitive. And what that means is the material has been determined to be pornographic or otherwise indecent under Utah law. And so prior to this law, there wasn't a single school district in Utah removing it based on that objective standard, or at least putting that into writing, if that makes sense. So what's going to have to happen, or what the Utah State Board of Education is in the process of determining, is how schools will go back and apply that objective sensitive standard to previously banned books.
Yeah, interesting. I want to go back just a little bit. So individual school districts have been using the 2022 law. Have their books banned and removed in districts?
Yeah. So in October 2023, we did do kind of a deep dive into the titles of those books that were removed. And I have to, you know, preface this with saying that we didn't look at every single district in the state, and the research didn't include charter schools, so our list is by no means comprehensive, but it did include some of the largest school districts that make up the majority of student population in the state. And at that time, since 2022, there had been 262 titles removed across, I think it was 17 districts that we looked at. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tribune had some good reporting on that. Offhand, do you remember the kinds of books that were some of the kinds of books that were removed?
A lot of Sarah J. Maas. I think if I'm remembering correctly, just a lot of kind of fantasy novels. Looking at that, and again, with prefacing this with this is no means accurate number, but just looking at our database and looking at which titles were removed in three districts, there were at least 36 titles. So whether or not they meet that objective sensitive, criteria is yet to be determined.
So the objective is new. So that's the language is pornographic or indecent, right? And this is according to state law. I'm guessing state law has some criteria for that.
It does. I can't cite the exact code, but basically the way lawmakers have described it is it is pornographic in nature with no educational value.
Mm-hmm. Now the subjective, the old subjective rule that remains in force, right? It's just that you can use subjective if you want to ban it for your district, but it has to be objectively indecent to ban it statewide.
Correct. And subjective is a new criteria too.
Oh, that's a new criteria. Okay.
Yeah, it is. And that it basically defines like whether it's objective or subjective, defines the process for removal. So somebody reviewing a book, right, could look at it and say, well, it's not objectively sensitive, but it could be subjectively sensitive, and it has to go through further steps for review.
Mm-hmm.
And then that'll be determined at the district level as they create these new policies to comply with the new statewide ban law.
So how does this work? I guess either on the old or the new, does somebody have to bring this to the attention saying, hey, I think this is a bad book. And then who at the district reviews it?
So each policy is determined at the different, at the district level. But generally how this works is if somebody submits a book challenge, it's reviewed, who, that's a good question, also varies by district, but generally there are committees that look at these books. The old process was kind of removing it or keeping it on the shelf, but the new process will be, is it objective? If it is objective, then it's automatically removed, right? Like there is no further review process. It's just automatically taken off shelves. If it's subjective, then it would go through a second review, which I would imagine involves committees.
So this would be for books in school libraries, right?
It's for any material.
Yeah.
That would be in a school, okay. Whether that's a presentation or a textbook or anything.
Yeah. I suppose a child or a family, if they disagree with a book being banned from their school's library, they go search for it elsewhere. But I guess there's the other part of this, the message sent is, I could see some would find that problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the argument is that this new law takes away local control over what's in schools. Because I think it's about like 10% of districts under this new law will pretty much control what other districts have, in their school, what books other districts have. And, I think that's been, upsetting for a lot of, people.
Do we have any estimates at all about how many books will be considered for statewide ban?
Well, I only know about the list that we compiled in October. So again, narrowing that down from the 262 books we looked at across, 17 different districts, there were 36 titles that where they were banned in three districts or more. So probably, you know, I would say at least those 36 titles. But then again, the schools will have to go back and re-review those titles and apply that objective, subjective criteria. So even though, I mean, we know based on that database that 36 titles have been banned in three districts or more, that that may or may not mean they'll get on the statewide ban list. There's just a lot up in the air right now.
Mm. Well, thanks for telling us about this. Appreciate that.
Of course.
And I want to come back to you just briefly here in this segment. But Robert Gerke, what do you think about this story?
Yeah, the saga of book banning just keeps going in Utah, doesn't it? I mean, I think, you know, Carmen mentioned this, but I think this is, from my perspective, the point that is worth focusing on is that we trusted local districts to do this because they're elected by their constituents, right? It's done at the local level. It reflects the local wishes and desires. And if they're not, then they get voted out of office. But now we've just taken that away because, you know, for a while, the legislature was content to let these local districts decide. Now they weren't deciding the way the legislature wanted. And so now, as she mentioned, it comes down to a handful of, you know, the most conservative districts in the state. If they ban a book, then it's banned forever and in all of the districts. And it just, it takes away any local accountability, local control, and, you know, takes it out of the hands of parents. And I'm not saying that every book belongs at every school, you know, regardless of age and content, you know, but the whole point of setting up these boards to review these books and having librarians who are trained in how to do this, having it in their hands is so it reflects the local standards. And I think we're getting away from that. There's a lack of accountability, as I said, and I think it's really unfortunate because what we have seen across the country is that there's this crusade to root out things that are written that reflect anything that's LGBTQ or, you know, potentially racially, problematic, I guess, from their perspective. And that is narrowing the options that kids have, and it makes it so they don't see themselves in the materials that they're able to read. So, you know, we're moving in the wrong direction, but we knew when this passed the legislature that this was the way that we were going to end up. And I think it's an unfortunate direction for the state to be moving in.
Carmen, I want to just a couple minutes on this, but I think this is an important story to get the word out. Here's the headline. After an online sextortion threat, a Utah teen died by suicide. Now his parents are warning others. I wonder if you just briefly tell us how these, perpetrators, scumbags, I guess, how they're ensnaring young people. Just tell us briefly how it's done, because maybe that could be a warning to parents and to kids.
Scumbag is a pretty good term for them. So the first thing about sextortion, which I learned attending this community meeting, is that it typically, in the cases we're talking about, is specifically for financial gain. These people are not, what ends up happening is they pose as a teenager, and kind of solicit, explicit photos from these teens. And they are more often than not teenage boys. And then they use those photos by manipulating them using AI or Photoshop, and they use them and they say, if you don't give me money, I'm going to release these photos. And so this is kind of a very, I don't know, unique situation compared to, you know, a child predator, right? This is specifically for financial gain. And I think that's important for parents to know. And it's been happening more and more, like numbers are rising across the nation.
Yeah. And this, and of course, the consequences obviously can go beyond, money. Kids this age don't have the tools to handle something like this. This young man killed himself. So what do law enforcement say to parents and to kids to, you know, if you're victim to this or if somebody is trying to victimize you with this?
Yeah. They said communication, having open communication with your kid is really important, and creating a space for them where they feel safe coming to you and saying, hey, I made a mistake. In this instance, that was, you know, not the situation where the child, at least from what the parents told me, they had a really good relationship with their son. He just didn't see any other way out. And just the mere education, you know, educating A, parents, B, children about this sort of scheme, right, will help them recognize when it's happening. So education and communication is what law enforcement recommended.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks for the story. Check it out at sltrib.com. Also, Carmen, you have on the story, missingkids.org. Look for sextortion under missingkids.org. You find out more information on this. Thanks, Carmen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Robert, anything you want to say on this story?
Just Carmen, quick question. I mean, this is a crime, right? I mean, these kids can and probably should be charged. Yeah. I mean, I do hope prosecutors take this very seriously.
The challenge with it though, is a lot of these people are in developing nations. And they dedicate their whole entire like day to, targeting multiple teens. So it's very difficult to prosecute in these cases.
Yeah, I see. That makes sense. So I guess in that context, yeah, the only recourse then is for people to be vigilant about it, for parents to be aware and protective of their kids. And it's the internet has opened up this Pandora's box of potential harms and real, in this case, real severe harms. And I think it is, like you said, a despicable act that these guys are doing. And there's just probably a special place in hell for people like this.
Well, yeah, thanks for alerting this, and hopefully the word gets out so we can have fewer victims of this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. After a break, we'll be talking with education reporter Michael Lee. Here's the headline. Salt Lake City School District resumes a plan to train all students on what restrooms they can use. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the next headline. Salt Lake City School District resumes a plan to train all students on what restrooms they can use. We're turning to education reporter Michael Lee. Michael, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So the headline up until, I think, this morning was they'd paused a plan. Now they're resuming it. This as well is responding to legislation, right? Tell us briefly what the legislation is.
Yeah, so the legislation, which was, at the time during the legislative session, noted as House Bill 257, which is the sex-based designations for privacy, anti-bullying, and women's opportunities, which essentially bans transgender and non-binary students from, in the case of schools specifically, it would not allow them to essentially use the restroom that they identify with, right? In the bill language, it essentially says, you know, they have to use the restroom of the gender that they were born with. So, that's essentially what the legislation says. Yeah, at least for schools. Sorry.
And so, as I understand it from your story, the legislation requires school districts to inform children, I guess families, about the law. So that's mm-hmm. what's happening here.
Yeah, and that's kind of where this story gets into a lot of somewhat controversy, I would say, within the parents in Salt Lake City School District and the district themselves, and in the sense that you know, right, like you mentioned, the original story that we had published was that Salt Lake City School District paused the plan to train all students on you know, the restrooms that they can use. And just for some context, originally the district had created two slideshows. One was for students in K through 5, and the other was for students in grades 6 through 12. And in both PowerPoints, they basically you know, outlined you know, very, very much just essentially paraphrased the bill language, right? And I think for like the K through 5 presentation, for example, you know, it was, if you were born a boy, you need to go to the boys' restroom. You know, if you were born a girl, you need to use the girls' restroom. And that was basically, I mean, they had some other things in there, you know, if you don't know, like come talk to administrator, like, you know, if you don't know what restroom you should use, come talk to administrators. You know, they also offered, you know, Safe UT, which is the state's kind of crisis tip line and whatnot. And so, yeah, I mean, and this is part of, like you mentioned, in the law, it states that the schools are required to, school districts are required to notify students. But that's kind of why the district paused it, right? Because there was some parent feedback and some parent blowback on this. And we can definitely, get into that a little later, but that wasn't the reason. The reason was because of that language specifically in the bill was, at least their spokesperson that told me at the time, you know, it was, they felt like there was a lack of clarity when it came to that language. It was, to be frank, pretty vague. It just said that, you know, they just need to notify students. It didn't really say how they should notify students, you know, whether should it be in an assembly, should it be, you know, in this case, you know, I think Granite School District told me, and, you know, so this is what Salt Lake City School District first reverse course on. They essentially paused the training to decide to, oh, we're going to first reach out to impacted families. You know, students that will be directly impacted through this law, which is parts of which are set to go into effect next week on, I think, May 1st. It's the bill language that kind of, you know, is the reason why this whole thing happened, right? Why they paused it, because they just weren't sure. You know, they wanted to make sure that they knew how to, from my understanding, what they told me, how to go forth and really still make sure they were complying with the law.
You mentioned some parents were upset by the proposed training. I understand the training hasn't changed, so I assume those parents will still be upset. Why were they upset?
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest things is kind of, you know, one of the parents I spoke to, she actually organized last Friday at Emerson Elementary. It was like a 15-minute, you know, dance party is kind of what they called it. And it was essentially, you know, it was very much a dance party, but also sort of a rally to kind of protest the new law as well as the school's presentation to the students, right? And that was a big part because they felt that she said a lot of, you know, in a lot of parent group chats, and she's actually told me that she's friends with parents of transgender students as well, right? And they were upset with the language of the presentation, right? And because it really just simply says, you know, if you're a boy, go to the boys' restroom, if you're a girl, go to the girls' restroom. And they felt as though that language didn't exactly reflect or recognize at all students who are non-binary or who are transgender, right? And I think that was one of the biggest things. And they felt as though it made them feel erased. It made them feel unwelcome. And they simply just wish that the district went about this in different ways, especially, you know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, they heard that Granite School District, for example, wasn't releasing district-wide presentations like this. It was, they had, and I spoke to the spokesperson about this last, on Monday, and, you know, at the time he said that they were, you know, they had given info sheets to the principals who, you know, who were also reaching out to impacted families, right, specifically. And so it was a lot of just frustrations with how it was rolled out. And the fact that it would be shown to, again, every student, with the caveat of, as well, that they felt that, you know, again, non-binary and transgender students were not being recognized by the district, which, you know, the district has, you know, come out in this, in the updated story, and kind of said that, you know, that wasn't our intention, you know, and our intention was really just to comply with the law. And these presentations do not, you know, reflect that they are taking a specific stance on, you know, which students they support, you know, what's, you know. And so, yeah, they definitely tried to make that clear to me that the presentations were worded as is because of how the law was worded, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Finally on this, Michael, will there be accommodations for transgender and non-binary students?
Yeah, and so that's kind of where, you know, the district has already implemented those plans. And I think, I don't know how long they've had these plans for, but essentially, you know, they have a policy. I think it's called their G24 gender. It's a administrative policies for gender inclusion, or something along those lines, where if it essentially is where, you know, if a student you know, doesn't know or doesn't feel comfortable, you know, going to the restroom that they were, you know, assigned to at birth, right? They can go to the district, or their family, them and their families can go to the district, you know, let them know. And essentially that policy allows them to work with the district to create a plan. So this, in the context of the bill, includes, you know, there, I think some school facilities have, you know, gender neutral restrooms, from my understanding. You know, I could be wrong, but I think that's what I read in some of the policies or and whatnot. But, you know, for example, the, you know, they could come up with a plan to use a, you know, a private, more private restroom that's in the school building, right? And just some stuff pops off the top of my mind, meaning a single person like faculty restroom or something, right? That's just an example that I just listed off, right? But like something like that, from my understanding, that's what those plans are designed for, is for those students who, you know, again, aren't comfortable going to those restrooms, you know, due to, you know, either how they identify or whatnot. And so, yeah, those are the resources. And that's actually how the district plans to, you know, impacted families is in quotations, right? And, you know, I know there's some questions of, you know, how do you identify the impacted families, right? How do you know? And those are the families who are actually already under that G24 support plans, and those students who already have those support plans. And so, yeah, the district does have resources for those families, but they, you know, they did mention to me, right? It's like they can only provide those resources if those families and if those students come to us for that. From my understanding, again, that's just from my understanding, from my, what I've understood from what they've told me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I want to have you talk just very briefly, just a couple of minutes, on another story you had, I guess a couple of weeks ago, but it's so related, at least in my mind. So we're talking about the transgender law, just, you know, laws, series of laws passed by the legislature. You have another story in which you talk to some folks trying to deal with ramifications for Utah's new anti-DEI law. So you went to Guadalupe School. It's a public charter school. They said they've got plans in place. They're not going to be too affected by this new law, but they're concerned about, I think, adults coming to the, I guess, the night school, or they're concerned about when their students go up to higher grades. Give me your 1 minute version of this.
Yeah, so it's actually more so of because they, you know, the way that their charter is set up in general, I mean, it's just not affected by the law, just of how they enroll students. You know, they don't, you know, specifically use race or, you know, or DEI to, you know, enroll students, if that makes sense. And but it is more of, I think they're more concerned of the future of their students, right? And in that story, we also spoke to, you know, the CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters Utah, which is kind of a mentoring program in education here. And so it's more of concern of, yeah, the students in the state who, you know, K through 12, or like you mentioned, adult education students who want to pursue a degree in higher education, right? And these are immigrants. These are, you know, people who moved to this country with other degrees, right? And, but, you know, have to relearn all of that here, that have taken advantage of resources such as the University of Utah's DEI office, or I think it's EDI office. And so, yeah, they essentially, you know, they talked to me about how they don't really know what this looks like yet, right? We can't really, it's hard to crystal ball until the law goes into effect. But you know, they do feel like they will have to, you know, talk to their kids differently, right? About that college is for them, right? Even though some of these resources are may dissolve or may change, right? And you know, they may provide various other again, don't really know what that looks like quite yet, but they would like to provide more resources for the future of their students, right? And it'll take they will take more of that, I guess, weight on their shoulders as these resources change and potentially dissolve. Yeah.
So check out that whole story from Michael Lee at sltrib.com. Michael Lee, education reporter, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Robert Gerke, at least in my mind, these two stories were quite related. That under the rubric of legislature passes legislation and then districts and others have to try to figure it out. What do you think about these two stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit it on the head. It's put these districts in a pretty difficult situation, and more importantly, I think put these kids in a difficult situation. I've talked to teachers who are kind of frustrated with the spotlight that this is putting on certain children in the schools, or even, you know, raising a discussion that wouldn't otherwise necessarily need to be had, and now it's front and center in these classrooms, and it's you know, I guess maybe an unintended consequence, or maybe it's part of, you know, part of the structure the legislature wanted. The districts don't really have a lot of choice. They do need to, you know, inform students about how to, you know, how something that they've always taken for granted, and that's going to the bathroom, I think. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the real damage is probably being done to the students themselves, and also, you know, just putting a spotlight on these kids in something that should be a private situation that school districts have always just navigated themselves without the heavy hand of the legislature coming in and telling them how they have to do this. And it's not just going to be school districts that have to deal with this. I mean, cities, counties, government buildings, things like that, they're going to have to try to navigate this too and figure out how they delineate and inform people about the rules that are in place. And so, yeah, it's unintended consequences, maybe, or maybe just things that the legislature didn't care enough to think about when they passed this bill, and now we're seeing the challenges it's presenting.
Let's head toward another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. After break, we'll be talking with religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Here's the headline: Will and should the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints ever seal same-sex couples in temples? We'll be talking about a recent survey of church members. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Tamara, thanks for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Happy to be here.
So a new study, a survey out from B.H. Roberts Foundation about possibility, advisability of solemnizing same-sex marriages in the temples of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. What are the top-line findings?
Yeah, I think it's helpful, first of all, just to do a real quick explanation of sealing versus...
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, so marriage within the civil context, right, is something that the church has done some work getting behind bills like the Utah Compromise, others that have, and I'll let Robert, if he wants to talk more in depth about this later on, but what happens in LDS temples is called a sealing, and that is between a biological male, biological female only. And what is done there is believed to be the union of that couple for this life and the next. And that is really important. It's considered necessary for salvation. And the sort of highest and most sacred ordinance, it's only done in temples. It's a very simple, very sort of solemn ceremony. And as I mentioned, it's it is one that is done just between, like I said, biological men and women. And so what this organization, it's a kind of, it's on the newer side, it's called the B.H. Roberts Foundation. They sent out a whole bunch, 80,000 postcards up and down the Mormon corridor from Idaho down into Arizona. And then they did a lot of recruiting on Facebook, using Facebook ads to find people to weigh in on what on this survey that ultimately included almost 3,900 respondents who identified as currently a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And among the questions that they looked at was if the church should solemnize these sealings between same-sex couples in temples, and whether it will. And it was between 60 to 70% of U.S. Latter-day Saints who responded to this said no. They do not think that the church should seal same-sex couples. And what was interesting here was the different types of respondents. So the ones living outside of the Mormon corridor or the Jello Belt or the Book of Mormon Belt, whatever you want to call it, they tended to be more supportive of same-sex sealings. However, those who were living within the Mormon corridor, they leaned more towards, they were less comfortable with the idea. And just kind of the broad numbers here, so I don't get your listeners too bogged down into numbers and percentages, is that for all groups that I just described, between 55 to almost 70% said they strongly disagreed with that. And less than 10% of all groups strongly agreed. Excuse me. And then they looked, like I said, at will the LDS Church eventually seal same-sex couples? And here, the numbers were even more on the same page. Between 60 and 75% of all groups said it was very unlikely. And less than 5% of all groups said very likely. The second most selected option was unlikely. So it had very unlikely, unlikely, somewhat unlikely, neither, and so forth. So overwhelmingly, the members of the church do not see this as in the plans or on the books.
What is, have church leaders spoken out about the future of this? Of course, the, you know, the current position of the church is, you know, very firm opposition to sealing mm-hmm. same-sex couples in the temples. Mm-hmm. Have they spoken out about future?
Yeah, they've said this will never change. This is mm-hmm. a forever doctrine. Yeah, so they've been, especially current apostle, senior apostle Dallin H. Oakes, who's in the First Presidency, which is the governing body, has been especially emphatic on this point, and he is next in line for a prophet once, whenever, maybe never, the 99-year-old president of the church passes.
Hmm. I guess one more thing on this, Tamara, then I'll have Robert comment, and then hopefully have a little time for you to talk about another one of your stories, but... So you note this in your first sentence in your story, Latter-day Saints are increasingly comfortable with the idea of civil marriages for same-sex couples. You've delineated that, you know, the large majority opposed to sealings in the temple, but open to the idea of marriages outside the temple.
Yeah. It's about half. It's about half of U.S. Latter-day Saints are on board with same-sex marriage in the civil realm. And I think that partly speaks to how important and different the idea of sealing is in the minds of Latter-day Saints compared to civil marriage. And then I just really quickly, though, want to just touch on the pitfalls in the data of this, which is that, for one, you are going to get the most exercised group on this, on when it comes to opt-in polls, right? The people who have the strongest opinions. And one way the group got around this was by not advertising it as being about any particular topic. It wasn't like, take this poll about how you feel as a Latter-day Saint on same-sex ceilings. It just said, here's our study about Latter-day Saints. We'd love any Latter-day Saint to participate in. So I think that was something worth pointing out. And the other is how they found people on Facebook, which is that they used individuals who had showed interest in Brigham Young University or other Utah-centric educational institutes, sports teams, and the Beehive State in general as a way to identify Latter-day Saints on Facebook. So of course there are large, sizable segments of Latter-day Saints who are maybe first generation converts or live outside of the Mormon quarter and they're not on Facebook, or they just simply don't have any sort of connection to Utah culturally or socially. They would have been just invisible to these researchers. And I do think that's worth pointing out. Nonetheless, the number of respondents they got means that we really have to grapple with these numbers. They are, it's one of the biggest studies of all time on U.S. Latter-day Saints. And it's really quite remarkable how many responses they got.
Yeah. Thanks for telling us about this. To Mark Hemsley, religion reporter. Robert Gerke, what do you think about this story?
Well, it's always difficult to, you know, talk about what religions should be doing. But I think, you know, I think there is in their mind a clear delineation between civil unions, civil marriages, and you know, a religious right. And so I think there's not really a place for governments to tell them that they need to be doing this. I don't think that's the role of a government to tell people how what they can and can't do in terms of religious context. But we've also seen over decades and generations that the church's practices do change. And I'm thinking specifically of, you know, giving African Americans the priesthood in 1978. That was a reaction to, I think, obviously, from the church's standpoint, it was a revelation, but there was also a strong social undercurrent. And had they not done that, they would have been seen as pariahs for the next 50 years, right? So these things do tend to change over time. But I think as Tamara noted, the numbers at this point would indicate that it changes when the parishioners change, right? And so I think it's going to be a long time coming if and when the church ever changes this policy.
Thanks, Robert. We just have about a little over a minute, and hate to give short shrift to this, but I do want to have you mention Tamara, extraordinary person, LDS Latter-day Saint scholar, Melissa Inouye, died this past Tuesday of cancer at age 44. Give me your 1 minute version of this extraordinary person.
Melissa Inouye was 44 when she passed away on Tuesday early in the morning from cancer. She had been battling cancer for 7 years, and she is just a universally beloved scholar of Mormonism, and in particularly global Mormonism. And she is well known for pushing the study of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to be more inclusive globally, that, and as well as her personal writings about struggling as a sacred practice have been made her a very influential voice. And her death was it has been a big and heavy blow to many members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who are familiar with her work.
Check out tomorrow's story, also Peggy Fletcher Stack's story in the sltrib.com to get a sense of this extraordinary person, Melissa Inouye, who will be greatly missed. Robert Gerke, we just have 30 seconds to a minute before Underplayed Stories. I wonder if you give us the very short version of your story about gubernatorial candidates and their views on immigration.
Yeah, it was more just a Q&A that we did with each of the candidates who were running for governor. And we wanted to do it ahead of the Republican convention tomorrow. So we focused primarily on the Republicans, but you can read nominee Brian King's responses as well. Not surprisingly, they think that the Biden administration has done a bad job across the board of dealing with immigration. One of the more interesting pieces of it was, you know, we asked if they still support the principles of the Utah Compact, which was a policy statement that was put in place back in 2010 and then reiterated in 2019 about keeping families together, about, you know, a humane immigration policy. And Carson Jorgensen and Phil Lyman both said that they can't support that document any longer. Took a little bit of a harder line on it. Carson Jorgensen, I believe, said, you know, this has been an invasion. So did Sylvia Mira Fisk, one of the Republican candidates. And so, you know, it gives the goal here is, and I think would encourage readers to go see what each of the candidates said, because the goal here is help educate voters and educate delegates for the Republican convention about where they stand on the issue that, frankly, I think 91% of Republicans nationally say is the top issue this election.
Well, thank you for that. Check that out at sltrib.com. It's time for Underplayed Stories of the Week here on Behind the Headlines. Carmen Nesbitt, what's your Underplayed Story of the Week?
Am I allowed to pitch my own story?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Lame? Pitch away.
So we have numbers in for private school voucher applications, which I know has been kind of a heated issue here, but the application window closed and it seems like they got about 27,000 individual people or students, well, parents on behalf of students applied. And there's only 10,000 scholarships available. So only a third will get a voucher. And the story is titled, "Only a Third of Utah School Voucher Applicants Will Get One. Here's What's Next."
All right. Check that out at sltrib.com. Michael Lee, what's your Underplayed Story of the Week?
Mine is from our colleague Sophia Jeremias about when you should start watering your lawn in Salt Lake City. I just am a big fan of news that you can use. And this is definitely, I feel like, news that is useful, but also very just informative, because I feel like, you know, I always feel like, oh, yeah, and when it's spring, you know, time to water your lawn. Not that I have a lawn, but but, you know, it's like back with my parents, when I was living with my parents, you know, it's like, yeah, it's turn on the water. But here it's, you know, it's a little different here. It's a little different. So.
All right. News you can use. SLTrib.com. Thanks, Michael. Tamara Kemsley, what's your Underplayed Story of the Week?
I think that one that is worth noting in light of recent news events is the conversation on our Mormon Land podcast this week with scholar Matthew Bowman about near-death experiences, the book Visions of Glory, and spiritual warfare movement within the LDS faith and tradition, and how it contributes to individuals like the Daybells, like Ruby Frankie, Jody Hildebrandt, and that whole ecosystem that is a subculture within Mormonism is worth listening to.
Check that out at sltrib.com. Thanks for that. Robert Gerke, what's your Underplayed Story?
I was going to mention the one that Tamara's story that we already discussed, so I'll pick another one. Brian Schott did a piece about Senator Mike Lee endorsing Celeste Malloy's challenger. It's unusual for a Republican to endorse while they're still, you know, before there's a nominee. And in this case, in particular, for a sitting senator to endorse an incumbent's opponent. So he endorsed Colby Jenkins, who is running against her, and you know, said he's going to endorse others, and that probably means pointing to an endorsement in the Senate race, that crowded Senate field, to replace Senator Romney. And you know, Mike Lee has a lot of clout in the Republican Party, and particularly among the delegates. So you can check that out at sltrib.com.
sltrib.com, yes. I would choose one of tomorrow's stories. I'll just read the headline. It's intriguing. Why this faithful Latter-day Saint drives 6 hours to buy liquor he will never drink. A fascinating story. Check that out at sltrib.com. Well, we've been talking with education reporters Carmen Nesbitt and Michael Lee, also religion reporter Tamar Kemsley, and news columnist Robert Gerke. And thanks, everyone, for joining us for Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Join us again next time.